Please bear in mind that we are writing about a hypothetical situation, and do not mistake that for thinking that we are advocating that military action should be used. Quite the contrary, Mike and I are actually rather optimistic, to the shock of our hardline friends, that with some renewed vigor behind it, that the diplomatic process may in fact be successful. We, after all, have persuaded Iran in 2003 to suspend its nuclear program for a while. And so there are indeed prospects we could do that again. The point of our study is to look at this hypothetical, not to advocate, and we certainly don't think that it would be appropriate to adopt this policy right now for reasons which we explain. We have two major messages and two speakers this afternoon, so we've divided up the work. I'm going to concentrate on one message, which is that context matters. And then Mike Eisenstadt is going to discuss the other major message, which is the metrics by which to judge whether or not a preventive force is or is not successful. So let me plunge into this discussion about context. Many people who talk about the, how the use of military force against Iran is just unthinkable, don't have enough imagination. Let me just give you an example of a situation in which I think the debate about this would be entirely different than the debate today. Let us suppose that Iranian leaders were to announce that they are, in fact, are developing a nuclear weapon, that they have left the NPT, and that they intend to test a nuclear weapon. Under those circumstances, I would just suggest to you the debate about preventive military force would be entirely different than what it would be today. And in particular, since we have, many of us for some time, said that we have firm indications that Iran is developing dangerous nuclear capabilities, but it is not as clear whether or not Iran actually has a nuclear weapons design program, the famous statement in the National Intelligence Estimate, which focused on that design program, overemphasized that aspect but of the overall nuclear effort. But there is quite a debate in the analytical community as to whether or not Iran's intention is simply to have a rapid breakout capability or actually to develop a weapon. And there are many people who would argue that Iran may only develop a rapid breakout capability, bring itself to the brink, but not actually build a nuclear weapon. And after all, Supreme Leader Khamenei has frequently said not only that Iran has no intentions of having nuclear weapons, but that it would be un-Islamic for anyone to use nuclear weapons. If, in that context, Iran were to announce that, oh, by the way, you can ignore what we've been saying for the last 25 years, actually we are developing a nuclear weapon, and we do intend to test it, that would cast grave doubts on how accurate have been our assessments of what Iran intends to do, and would force us to reconsider just how well we can predict future Iranian actions. And that, I would hope, would therefore cast doubt on the certainty that we might have as to what Iran would do once it acquired the nuclear weapons. Because today there is analytical unanimity that Iran would not use nuclear weapons in a battlefield sense if it acquired them. It would only use them as demonstrating its capabilities, why it's a powerful country, why it should be paid attention to provide itself an umbrella for carrying out activities, and many other such things. But if it turns out that we have been so wrong about what it is that Iran was doing, we might have to reconsider that. And I would suggest that an Iranian announcement that it intends to make nuclear weapons and to test them would cause quite an international political crisis. And if in that ensuing crisis Iran persists in its behavior and refuses to change course, then I would suggest that the question of preventive military action would be viewed very differently by many around the world. I could well imagine a situation in which the use of preventive military force would become thinkable. Indeed, I can imagine a situation in which many around the world, indeed many in Iran, might take the attitude that it's unfortunate that that military force was used, but that's the way things went. So I choose this extreme example to point out to you that context matters. And that to say that the use of preventive military force today is unthinkable, unimaginable, is hardly to say that it would always be unthinkable or unimaginable. And indeed, I would suggest that we do point out several other factors which would make quite a difference in the context of the use of force. For instance, domestic Iranian politics. To the extent that Iran is being led by hardliners who are seen by their own people as being not necessarily the most cautious and careful, most sober, but instead as risk takers and overly assertive and overly confident. Well, that creates one context. But if Iran, for instance, next year were to elect a new president who is seen as a new hope, a new vision, a man of moderation, a man who's ready to compromise and work out deals, that would be a very different context. So the domestic Iranian context matters quite a lot for how the use of military force would be received both in Iran and around the world, including in the United States. Similarly, what's happening on the international diplomatic front? If the UN Security Council is debating a new resolution which would impose severe restrictions upon Iran, and in the course of those, while those debates are ongoing, the United States were to use preventive military force, this would probably be poorly received. But if international diplomacy were widely seen to have reached a dead end, if our European allies who are leading this effort were to throw up their hands and say, there's nothing more we can do, this has reached an impasse. That's a very different context. So the state of how international diplomacy is proceeding would also matter for how this preventative military force is viewed and what Iran would do in the aftermath of the use of this force. Now, so far I've been discussing hypotheticals. But one of the things that we did in doing this study, one of the things which I frankly find mystifying, almost embarrassing, that other people who have thought about this issue and written about it have not done as much as I would have expected them to do, is to look at the past record. After all, we now have almost 30 years of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and we have a number of occasions on which the United States has engaged in the use of military force against the Iranians. What happened in those circumstances? Did Iran respond with a kind of dramatic retaliation, which we often hear would be the inevitable consequences of any strike against Iran's nuclear facilities? Was there an outpouring of nationalist sentiment and sympathy for the Islamic Republic, as we are often told would inevitably occur? The record is actually much more complex. There are times when that happened, and there are times when that did not happen. I am particularly struck that there is only one time, as far as I can tell, although I confess that my ability to research this is limited, there's only one time that a Secretary of State has resigned on a matter of principle out of opposition to a policy that a president was implementing. And that was Cyrus Vance in April 1980. And he did it over the Iran hostage rescue attempt because, as he describes in his autobiography, he thought that it would unleash a wave, a cataclysm of retaliation. He indeed ordered 900 U.S. diplomats and their families withdrawn from embassies around the world because he thought that there would be so much horror and reaction in response to the hostage rescue attempt. For your information, I'm unaware of a single demonstration anywhere in the world in response to that attempt. Now, you can say that's because of the context. We failed. Also, because Iran was very isolated, and there was not much sympathy for it even within the Muslim world. That just makes the point. Context matters. Let me remind you, in 1988, the United States shot down a civilian airplane, killing 280 innocent Iranians, completely our fault. Completely our fault. What was the response? Violent words, fiery language from Iran about how the Straits of Hormuz were going to be closed and U.S. interests worldwide were going to go up in flames. There was not one attack. There was not one demonstration. Moreover, 1 week later, Ayatollah Khomeini did what he described as being more difficult than drinking a cup of poison. He ended the Iran-Iraq war. The irony, and he did it, as he said in the letter that he sent at the time, because the United States was entering the war, in his view, and Iran could not fight both Iraq and the United States. The irony is that our killing of 280 innocent civilians ended a bloody war in which hundreds of thousands of people had needlessly died. Now, we also point out other situations, such as that in 1998, when the Taliban murder 9 Iranian diplomats and slaughter Shia, truly disgusting slaughter. Security Council, with vigorous U.S. support, adopts a resolution condemning this. This comes the same month that the United States had attacked the Taliban with missiles. Throughout Iran, there's a nationalist upsurge, a reaction against this. The regime mobilizes 200,000 soldiers and puts them on the border, and then stands down. Interestingly enough, what they chose to do instead was to dramatically increase their support for the Northern Alliance, using a different way to achieve their objectives. I am weighing the scales in one direction by giving you examples where Iran did not respond. We also give examples where Iran did respond, and some rather surprising ones. In April 1988, during the reflagging operation, the United States caught the Iranians red-handed sprinkling mines. We have pictures of them, of a film which we release of them sprinkling mines. And we decided that we can therefore sink an Iranian oil rig from which these boats were being launched, and that the U.S. Navy proceeds to do that. The Navy is so confident that Iran will not respond that they didn't even have an aircraft carrier nearby. The Iranians did respond, leading to the largest surface naval confrontation in 40 years, and the United States sinking half the Iranian Navy. And all of this being fought around oil rigs from which the oil workers were not pleased to be the close observers of this battle. Nobody had warned them this was coming, and nobody had suggested they might want to leave the scene of the battle. So, the past record suggests a complex pattern. Now, in this particular situation of the nuclear program, a key factor for context is going to be, how do we know? How do we know that the program has reached a stage that preventive military force is appropriate? We cannot count on Iran openly proclaiming that its intentions are to build a weapon or test it. So we will probably have to act on the basis of disputed intelligence. And that is going to be a real issue. How good is the intelligence? And there we suggest that if the International Atomic Energy Agency were to state that nuclear material is missing, that clandestine facilities have been discovered, that they have concerns about an Iranian nuclear weapons program, that would be quite an element weighing in the international thinking about what to do next. Because the IEA has much credibility, and they have been watching Iran quite closely. Now, the National Intelligence Estimate states that it is their judgment that if Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, they would do it using covert facilities. I don't quite understand that reference, since I always thought covert referred to something that everybody knows is happening, but that responsibility for it is hidden. I assume that they mean what I usually think of as clandestine facilities, that is to say, things which are not known about. But in any case, if Iran were to go that route, we would have a greater problem in detecting it and a greater problem in demonstrating it to the world. However, think about that one for a while, and the problem starts to become bigger and bigger. Because what Iran would have to do, if it wanted to go entirely clandestine, would have to have an entire fuel chain that's clandestine. This is not just a problem of how do they enrich the stuff. It's not certainly not a problem of how do they enrich it from low-enriched to high-enriched uranium, which is the last stage and is the most obvious weapons stage. But where do they get the stuff, the low-enriched uranium, that they start with? And you can say, well, they start with feedstock for that, which is uranium hexafluoride. Well, where do they convert that? And then you say, yellow cake. Well, where did they get the yellow cake? Where do they dig it up from the ground? In other words, there is an entire chain that is monitored by the IAEA and the world community. And the whole emphasis of the IAEA's entire existence is on nuclear accounting and safeguarding this chain to try to detect if anything goes missing. And in a case like Iran, the IAEA seems to be both quite technically competent and if I may say so, rather diligent in pursuing the matter. So if Iran were to divert some material at any stage in this process, there is quite a decent prospect that the IAEA would detect it. And if material went missing at any stage in this process, that would set off ringing alarm bells. What's going on here? Because a concern would be that the final stages of the process are stages which are relatively easier to hide, relatively easier to disguise as just ordinary industrial processes going on in a building, when in fact what's going on is the production of highly enriched uranium. And if Iran were to refuse to allow inspections of a suspect site, then I would think that the U.S. government's instinct would be to argue that either Iran allows inspections or they're going to lose that site. And that would be then that would become the debate. Is inspect it or lose it an appropriate policy? I don't know how the answer would come out, but I just suggest that would be a very different context than discussing military action today. Now, there are, of course, circumstances under which the United States intelligence community could come to the conclusion that Iran has made a dramatic breakthrough and that action is needed on an urgent basis that does not allow time for IAEA inspections. That would be quite a big challenge. However, let me just suggest that the Syria experience is very interesting, in that even though there was no information provided to the world community until after Israel struck, there seems to have been quite a widespread acceptance that what Israel did was indeed to hit a nuclear facility. And the initial Syrian denials are not widely credited. So even though the facility has been destroyed, there seems to be a pretty broad acceptance that in fact, this was a nuclear facility. It's not inconceivable, it's not unthinkable that military force might be used just on the basis of intelligence that is revealed afterwards. Well, look, let me just close by saying that what we are suggesting here is that how much support a strike has is a key factor in what happens post-strike. And as Mike is going to explain to you, our argument is that the post-strike situation is a very key metric in determining the success of the strike, that the strike should not be judged simply on the basis of how much does it destroy, but what happens post-strike. And that how much support we have in the United States for the actions taken, is it a controversial issue or is there broad support? How much support we have in the rest of the world? How much do Iranians object to what was done will be key factors here. And I would like to remind you that many of us have said that Iran is, in fact, sensitive to world opinion. And the record seems to suggest that. We see that in 2003, Iran did freeze its suspension and conversion activities. Yes, in part because of U.S. success on the battlefield, but also in part because it was the French, British, and German governments which wrote and said to the Iranians, you've got to do this. And the Iranians felt that the great powers were united in this. And the Iranians made the calculation that if the Europeans are supporting the Americans on this issue, they got to bend. And so opinion does matter. And I would also just say that the degree of world support for this action will also make a difference for how the strike affects global U.S. interests. Because we argue that the success or failure of the strike has to be judged not only by its impact on Iran, but by its impact on global U.S. standing. And that if this strike is seen as the act of mad cowboys by our allies in Europe, if this strike is seen by the Chinese as evidence that they've got to get into a Cold War-style competition with the United States that requires them to build thousands of nuclear missiles, that's not going to be good. On the other hand, if the strike is seen as by other potential proliferants around the world as indicating that proliferation is a really dumb idea and you really shouldn't even think about it because you're not going to be allowed at the end of the day to get nuclear weapons and you're just going to make your country into a pariah state and that you're going to invite a military attack by the United States, that would be a positive thing. In other words, a lot of what we reason that the United States, a lot of the reason that the United States is concerned about the Iranian nuclear program is because of our concern that global proliferation will ensue if Iran is allowed to violate its NPT obligations. And so, a lot of what we are doing here is looking at the question of what impact does this have on the global non-proliferation system. And that I've been treading on Mike's grounds, the metrics, and so I will cede the chair to him.